High noon in Vancouver, and this is the Brown Bagger on Co-op Radio, CFRO. We take you to the Trinity St. Paul's United Church in Toronto, November 20, 2006 for a barn-burning speech on the Middle East Wars by Scottish MP George Galloway.
No man could ask for a better introduction and a warmer welcome on this very cold night. It's probably not cold for you, but it's very cold for me. Brothers, sisters, comrades and friends, wassalamu alaikum. Peace be with all of you. And my thanks, first of all, to the people of this beautiful Christian church who have given over this space as part of their commitment to the justice and equity of which Ali spoke, making clear once again that whatever else is clashing in this world, this is not a clash between Christianity and the Muslims. I've just come from a TV studio, The Hour, I think it's called. You can see it at 11 o'clock if you're home. That's why I'm still wearing makeup. I wouldn't like you to think that I am. Well, I'll not go there. Okay, but I'll be speaking much louder later. I warm up. And the host of the show, George, young man, smart, I think he's probably on our side. We talked about Christianity and Islam. I told him, don't make the mistake of imagining that George W. Bush and Tony Blair are Christians. They blaspheme against the very idea of Jesus Christ with every policy that they pursue. Religious people, and I'm one myself, believe in the prophets, peace be upon them. Bush believes in the prophets and how to get a piece of them. We're very grateful for the hospitality given us by the church this evening, which is in action the kind of unity that we are seeking to build. Now, something I said at a press breakfast in Ottawa this morning seems to have captured the news, so much so that at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning on my way to the airport, I have to go to Canadian television to make a television interview about it. They seem to be very offended that I described Canadian foreign policy under Mr. Harper as absurd. Let me tell you why I think it's absurd. It's absurd to say that you're fighting for democracy in Afghanistan when you were the first government in the entire world to punish the Palestinian people with starvation because they voted for a party of which your government did not approve in the Palestinian election. That's absurd to me. It's absurd to me that Canada should wish to throw away the reputation that it had in the world, a reputation which only a few short years ago was everywhere recognized. Canada had, as I put it on television tonight, a baby face. It was seen as a country that was for peace and for development. And while other countries strode out across the world subjugating people, Canada was seen as a country that was more concerned with helping people. That was just a few short years ago. And I must tell you, I do not understand why Canada would want to join the ranks of the hated in the world. It's not in your interest, believe me, to be hated in the world. I speak as a citizen of a country which is one of the three most hated countries in the world. But when Canada, when Mr. Harper announced the beginning of a siege of the Palestinian people, who are now, and I'm not exaggerating, eating from the garbage heaps in Gaza, one of the poorest places on earth, where 75% of the people are living on less than one Canadian dollar a day. When you announce a siege on such a people, this is a declaration of war against the Palestinian people. And I don't know why your country did that. It's absurd that the Canadian Prime Minister should be weighing up whether or not he's prepared to speak to the President of China, the most populous country in the world. It's absurd to think, as they appear to do, that Canada has anything to say to the government of North Korea when Canada is seen increasingly as the indissoluble ally of George W. Bush, who's making war throughout the world and who's in possession of 30,000 nuclear weapons pointed in all directions. It's absurd. It's absurd to think that by sending soldiers to kill people in Afghanistan, they keep telling me, these news interviewers, no, no, they're killing Taliban. How do you know they're Taliban? They got a membership card in their pocket. And Taliban kill me. I say to these reporters, who are increasingly young, so it's difficult to make this point, but I ask them to go and look it up. Every day during the Vietnam War, the American media would report the U.S. Army's declaration that today they killed 100, 500, 900 Viet Cong. They weren't Viet Cong. They were just Vietnamese. And they're not Taliban. They're just Afghans that your soldiers and my soldiers are killing. You've killed a lot of Afghans, and the Afghans are starting to kill a lot of you, and you're making people hate you as a result. That, Mr. Harper, is an absurd foreign policy. That's my honest opinion as someone coming, you know, the Toronto Star, I think it was, on Friday or Saturday, they had a long article explaining that Johnny Foreigner, the non-Anglo-Saxon, was not shouldering sufficient of the burden. You'll remember that phrase, some of you. Empire used to be described as the white man's burden. the white Anglo-Saxon imperialist burden. According to the Toronto Star writer, Canada, the United States, and Britain are doing 90% of the dying. They're also doing 90% of the killing. Now, there's two ways of looking at this. You could look at it and say that Johnny, non-Anglo-Saxon foreigner, doesn't have the moral fiber to do the killing. Or you could ask yourself, maybe they know something that we don't know. Maybe they're the sensible ones with a proper foreign policy, and maybe it's the Anglo-Saxon terrible trio that's got it wrong. That's my take, and that's what I'll be saying on television tomorrow. Of course, it's not just that you're killing Afghans. By killing Afghans, you're relieving American soldiers to go to Iraq and kill Iraqis. And don't think that nobody has noticed. Don't think the Palestinians didn't know that it was your government who were the first to turn off the taps to try and starve them and punish them. Don't think the Muslim world doesn't know just how gung-ho a member of the coalition of the killing the Harper government is. Now, listen to this. Foreign policy is beginning to dictate the outcome of elections in powerful Western countries. Mr. Blair will be going soon, very soon. Remember, you heard it here, very, very soon. And he's not going because of the economy. The British economy is doing quite well for most people. He's not doing because of the state of the public services. The public services are better now than when they were, than what they were when he came to office. Mr. Blair is losing power in Downing Street very soon for one reason only, and that's his foreign policy infatuation with the George W. Bush government. Bush himself was given the mother of all beatings 2 weeks ago in the midterm elections, and not for any other reason than his foreign policy. Mr. Aznar in Spain is out because of his foreign policy. Mr. Berlusconi in Italy is out because of his foreign policy. Let's make sure in the next few months Stephen Harper is out because of his foreign policy. Tell you something else. That's absurd. It's absurd that you've got an opposition party that wasn't losing any sleep over massacres of civilians in Lebanon who declared that we will not mention the C word. Oh no. It wasn't the government, no. It's the opposition that wasn't losing any sleep. It was the opposition that wouldn't call for a ceasefire. For me, Harper and the Liberals are two cheeks of the same arse. I know about that, because we have such a system. We've got three parties, Tweedledee, Tweedledum, Tweedledee and a half. If it were anatomically possible, there would be three cheeks of the same arse. I don't know about elsewhere in this country, but it seems to me, in this area, the only party worth its salt is the NDP, and I hope that we get the results they deserve at the election. Now let me start. You thought I'd started, but I'm only warming up. Let me start with talking about what I'm not going to be talking about. If that doesn't sound too Donald Rumsfeldish. Wasn't it wonderful to see him go 2 weeks ago? I'm not going to be attacking the people of the United States of America. I am the great-grandson of probably the only woman in the entire 19th century who emigrated from America to Scotland when thousands were going in the opposite direction. I think she got on the wrong boat, and that's what happened. It's very important that we make it clear that in our attacks upon the policy of the United States, that not only are we not attacking the people of the United States, we salute them for finding their way through the fog of war propaganda and Fox News to the truth which delivered that beating to Bush and the neocons just 2 weeks ago. I always have to be careful because I never know which Americans are going to be in the audience. A couple of weeks ago I was speaking at the London School of Economics and I made my usual gag that I didn't mind having a special relationship with the United States of America. I just didn't want a special relationship like the one Miss Lewinsky had with President Bill Clinton. If we weren't in a church, I'd pursue that metaphor further. But a young man put his hand up at the back of the hall and asked me if this wasn't a little ungallant, as not only was Miss Lewinsky a student at the London School of Economics, she was sitting in row 17 of that very meeting. So I did what few politicians do. I made a swift, unqualified, and I hope gracious apology and promised Monica I would never tell that gag again. Another pre-election promise broken. The second thing I'm not going to be talking about is badly about the armed forces of your country, my country, or the United States of America. I often am greeted, I'm not sure if greeted is the word, by protesters outside meetings like this who hold up placards that say, "We support our troops." Well, it's a funny way to support your troops, sending them to get killed for a pack of lies, for a pack of liars. We're the ones who support our troops. We're the ones who want to support our troops by bringing them home for Christmas and keeping them here in our own country to defend us. The troops are lions led by donkeys, like Harper, like Blair, like Bush, like Howard in Australia. People who've never heard a shot fired in anger themselves. People who are not sending their own sons to kill and be killed. None of these columnists and broadcasters are queuing up at the army recruiting offices themselves, picking up their own tin hats and their own guns. They send other people's sons off to war. They're chicken hawks, ready to fight to the last drop of somebody else's blood for exploitation and domination around the world. And the third thing I'm not going to be talking about, and this is important to say in North America more than anywhere else, because here there is still a gigantic taboo about what I'm going to be talking about tonight, where people are routinely intimidated into silence, into forswearing to tell the truth. But when I attack Israel this evening, and when I attack Zionism this evening, none of it should be confused with the foul strain of racism called anti-Semitism. Nothing that we say is against Jewish people. There are thousands of Jewish people in our movement. You don't have to be a Zionist because you're a Jew. And you don't even have to like Jews to be a Zionist. Anybody who thinks George Bush and the Christian evangelical Bible-belting hypocrites of the Christian right in the United States like Jews have obviously never visited their golf clubs, have never visited their country clubs. This is a very important distinction to make. Nothing that we stand for implies any hatred or animus towards Jews. It's Israel and its policies of oppression and aggression and violence that we hate, not Jews. Now I want to start with that point because it's the heart of the matter. It is the flaw at the heart of Western policy towards the East. It's the biggest source of hatred and bitterness in the Muslim world about us, about our injustice, about our double standards, which are clearer and clearer for all to see. I gave an interview during the Lebanon War, early on a Sunday morning. Hardly anybody saw it on Sky News, which then went round the world. Thanks to the internet. As you just showed me, millions of people have seen this interview now, tens of millions in fact, thanks to the wonders of the new age that we live in, with the internet, about which I want to say more later. But the exchange was memorable for a number of things, quite unexpectedly. When I went into the studio, I had no idea that this would be anything other than a normal television interview, of which I do several every day. But I was particularly angry. My interviewer was particularly stupid. And some particularly dramatic things were happening on the other half of the split screen whilst I was speaking. But it was memorable most for this. This interviewer, and she is not alone, knew the name, the full name, the rank, and probably the serial number of all the Israeli soldiers she said had been, and I quote, kidnapped in Gaza and in Lebanon over the preceding few weeks. But when I challenged her to name one, just one, of the thousands of Palestinian and Lebanese victims who had fallen in the same period, she was completely dumbstruck, unable to give me a single name. And that shows the double standard. You see, Israelis have always got names. Americans, Canadians, British people have always got names. We hold 2 minutes silence for them. We erect memorials for them. We mourn them as we should. But we don't even count, never mind naming, the victims of the others. That's the truth of it. The blood of some people in this world is more valuable than the blood of others. And that's the shame. That's the real shame in this world. When Mrs. Blair and Mrs. Bush gave a simultaneous radio cast on the anniversary of 9/11, a synchronized swimming in the grief of that anniversary. It's bad enough that their husbands are in bed with each other. When their wives join them, it becomes positively obscene. And they asked us never to forget the heartbreaking messages of farewell left by those poor American women on those planes on 9/11 from their mobile telephones on the answering machines of their families, as if we could forget them. But as I said in Parliament afterwards, just because Afghan women don't have mobile telephones and Iraqi women don't have answering machines, it doesn't make their deaths any less obscene than the death of those American women on those planes on 9/11.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. You're listening to The Brown Bagger and a speech by George Galloway on Monday the 20th, 2006 at the Trinity St. Paul's United Church, recorded by CKLN News, Ryerson Campus Community Radio.
Now that for us is a truth self-evident, but for the powerful people who rule the world, it isn't true at all. General Powell, when tasked with the question, how many Iraqis have we killed? He said, we're not in the business of counting dead Iraqis. Just as well, because they've now reached a level beyond counting. According to the Johns Hopkins University and the Lancet, the magazine of the British Medical Association, Mr. Bush and Mr. Blair say they don't trust the statistics. I don't know about you. Whose word would you take? The Johns Hopkins University and the British Medical Association, or Tony Blair and George W. Bush? According to those sources, 655,000 Iraqis have perished in the war and in the occupation. On top of the 1 million Iraqis, most of them children, who died during the sanctions before they even knew that they were Iraqis. They were too young to know that they were Iraqis, but they were killed for no other reason than that they were Iraqis. They're not in the business of counting dead Iraqis, no wonder. But the truth is, they're not counting them because they don't consider them human beings on the same level as us.
Shame.
That's why they can lay waste to a whole country, to country after country, and claim that that's just collateral damage, like so much crumbling and fallen masonry. But the Palestinian issue is the heart of this, is the center of this. And if you don't begin to grasp that in North America, here and in the United States, it's a truth that I must tell you has been grasped almost everywhere else in the world. When I began campaigning for Palestine in the midsummer of 1975, hardly anyone in Britain supported the Palestinian cause. 5 years later, in 1980, when we twinned my city with the Palestinian city of Nablus and our town hall became the first public building in the Western world to fly the Palestinian flag 26 years ago, I can assure you it was a deadly, almost fatally controversial thing to do. But 26 years later, Every 29th of November, the Palestinian flag flies above the Dundee City Hall, and nobody even takes a bit of notice, because it is recognized that we were merely ahead of our time. But here in North America, that's a truth not yet grasped. Not grasped in Montreal, it's not grasped in Toronto. It's not grasped by your political parties. We're running scared from that truth. The Palestinian people are the victims of one of the greatest injustices in all human history. At the hands of Israel, paid for by the United States of America. That war that we talked about in Lebanon, every aeroplane, every warship, every tank, every shell, every rocket, every missile, every bullet, every gun, every salary of every Israeli soldier was paid, every cent, by the taxpayers of the United States of America. That's very, very important to know. Israel dropped 4 million cluster bombs on Lebanon. Three quarters of them in the last 72 hours, when the ceasefire had already been agreed. And one quarter of these cluster bombs did not explode and lie there now like landmines in the orchards, in the fields, by the roads of the south of Lebanon, a tiny part of a tiny country. Since the war, quote, finished, 80 Lebanese children have been blown to pieces by these cluster bombs. The Lebanese farmers must make the decision whether to go into their fields and plant, risking their limbs and their lives with these landmines lying there, or to leave their fields barren with no harvest next year. Every one of those bombs was sent by the United States of America. Every one of them was transshipped through my country, through our airports, and shipped to the Israeli Air Force to be dropped on the Lebanese people. And Mr. Ignatieff didn't lose any sleep. But of course, as I pointed out in that Sky News interview, this story didn't begin 4 weeks ago, or 4 years ago, or 14 years ago. My daughter is 24 years old. On the day in 1982, when she was given birth, I had to rush to the hospital to see her, born from a huge demonstration against the Israeli invasion and occupation of Lebanon. So, all 24 years of my daughter's life, Israel has been invading and occupying Lebanon. And these idiots think it began with the kidnap of two Israeli soldiers 4 weeks before. That's worth recalling what happened during that invasion in 1982. As I told you, I became involved in this in 1975. In 1977, I went to Lebanon for the first time. I spent time in two camps, then unknown, but which later, in 1982, etched themselves into the Hall of Infamy, the camps of Sabra and Shatila. In these camps lived thousands and thousands of Palestinian refugees. Israel invaded Lebanon. They smashed their way through the south. They perched their artillery on a high hill and systematically reduced the Arab capital of Beirut to ash. The great English journalist Robert Fisk, then writing for the London Times, I remember it still, described something he saw there for the first time. Little children, Palestinian and Lebanese, in hospitals in West Beirut, their insides cooking. Children baking from the insides. White smoke coming from their nose and mouth. Burning inside, incinerating inside with the use of phosphorus gas fired by the Israeli armed forces on Lebanon. So disastrous was the assault on Beirut that the leaders of the Lebanese National Movement called with heavy hearts and tears on their faces on President Arafat. I was there. They told him that the cost in human suffering was too great and that with a heavy heart they must ask the fighters of the Palestinian resistance to leave Beirut. Arafat agreed immediately and immediately concluded a deal with the American plenipotentiary Philip Habib, in which the Palestinian fighters agreed to leave Beirut with their weapons on board ships to sail thousands of miles to Tunisia. And in return, the so-called international community agreed to protect their women and children and old people that they were leaving behind in the camps. No sooner had these ships left the harbor when General Ariel Sharon, long may he lie in his coma and suffer, the butcher of Beirut, Sharon, personally, he didn't order someone to do it. He did it himself. Brought gigantic searchlights to the perimeter of the camps to shine through the night as bright as day, so the fascist butchers of the Lebanese phalange could go from house to house, from shack to shack, bayoneting the women, children, and old men that were left behind, killing thousands of them, leaving their bodies bloating in the sun in the camps for the next few days. The same Ariel Sharon that we were later told we must treat as a statesman, as a legitimate leader, whilst Arafat, who made the deal to save Lebanon, was blackguarded, was isolated, was insulted, and finally was murdered. That's the double standard. That's the injustice. The insult that's added to the injury is that in the Palestinians' case, the victim of terrorism is called the terrorist. And the terrorist state of Israel is called the legitimate government and the legitimate state. You know, they talk a lot about Ahmadinejad and his threat to wipe Israel off the map. Well, in fact, he never even said that. But in any case, Iran is not in a position to wipe Israel off the map. But Israel is in a position to wipe Iran off the map, and all other Arab and Muslim countries too. We know this thanks to the brave Jewish whistleblower, Mordechai Vanunu, who spent 18 years in solitary confinement in an Israeli dungeon for telling us. But in any case, the only country in the Middle East which has been wiped off the map is Palestine, wiped off the map by Israel, its people scattered to the four winds as refugees for half a century, living in camps, living in exile, with no papers, with no passports, with no status, with no national identity, hunted from pillar to post, massacred by Israel, by Arab regimes, unable to return to their homes. Whilst anybody can convert to being a Jew and be given the automatic right to go and live on the land and in the houses of the Palestinians who are forbidden to return home. And you know, there's one camp in particular which makes this point with perfect clarity. 4 years ago, at Easter time, when the Church of the Nativity, the birthplace of Jesus, was in flames, surrounded by Israeli tanks, priests and nuns lay dead, unburied in the crypt, and the Christian leaders of the world didn't lift a finger to come to the assistance of the birthplace of Jesus. That week, in a camp called Jenin, 1 square kilometer, 13,000 families, a camp consisting of rancid, rat-infested hovels, in which these 13,000 families had lived for 50 years. Now, the exquisite uniqueness of that camp is that if these shacks had roofs strong enough to stand on, the refugees of the camp could see the shining city of Haifa on the Mediterranean coast, which was their city. They can see from the camp their own houses, their own trees, their own gardens, their own oranges being lived in, played in, enjoyed by foreigners from Montreal, from Toronto, from London, from New York, mainly from New York, living in their houses, while these 13,000 families live in a state of indescribable misery. And they wonder why so many suicide bombers come from Jenin. The miracle is that they're not all suicide bombers coming out of the camp of Jenin. But on top of that misery, General Sharon, him again, 20 years later, sent his army to smash this camp and massacre its inhabitants. And I was there just 2 or 3 days after the massacre with my friend Ron Mackay, who's with me tonight. The smoke was still rising from the ruins. The smell of the bodies under the crushed houses, bulldozed flat like pancakes, could still be smelt. We saw a young man walking across the camp, carrying a sharp weapon. Very young man. We were surprised at the respect that the elders were paying him. We asked who he was. Turned out he was the leader of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, which had led the defense of the camp. We asked to speak to him. He told me this. And this I aim at the Arab Canadians here principally. He said, "Our young men fought day and night to defend this camp, to defend our families, to defend our religion, to defend our cause. But in the end, we could fight no more. Not because we ran out of courage, but because we ran out of ammunition. And why did we run out of ammunition, he said? Because the corrupt kings and the puppet presidents of the Arab world sealed their borders so that not a single bullet, not a single weapon, not a single volunteer could arrive to help defend the refugees in this Jenin refugee camp. And this too is a subject to which I shall return. But suffice to say this, even if the people of North America don't give a toss about the victims of Sabra and Shatila, the victims of Jenin, the victims of hundreds of massacres, even if they don't care about the Palestinian refugees, even if they don't care that Palestine has been wiped off the map, please believe me, the Muslims of the world care about it very much indeed. And it's one of the main reasons why there's such hatred against the West out there in that swamp of hatred and bitterness in the Muslim world, out of which the monstrosities of 9/11 and 7/7 in London and other atrocities climbed. Now, they often say to me when I make these points, well, what would you do? How would you get us out of this mess? I always say it's a bit much asking me to get you out of the mess. If you'd listened to me, you wouldn't have been in the mess in the first place. They say, what do you want us to do? Do you want us to negotiate with Osama bin Laden? Do you think bin Laden is interested in negotiating with us? I say, I don't know. You know him better than me. After all, you invented Osama bin Laden. He's only in Afghanistan because you sent him there. Don't try and hang bin Laden around my neck. I was the last man standing in the British Parliament. I mean literally. On the eve of the fall of Kabul to the so-called Mujahideen, of which the Taliban and bin Laden and the gang of warlord drug barons that your army and my army is currently defending in Afghanistan, on the eve of their triumph, and I told Mrs. Thatcher, you have opened the gates for the barbarians, and a long dark night will now descend upon the people of Afghanistan. And I never said a truer word. I say I'm not trying to negotiate with bin Laden. I want to negotiate with those Muslims who haven't joined him yet, but who may join him tomorrow because of their anger and their rage at the double standards of your governments towards the people of the East, towards the Muslim world, and in particular and specially towards the people of Palestine. So I said to them, give me the keys. I'll reverse the vehicle. But we have to go in the opposite direction. We have to make reparation to the Palestinian people. We have to start treating them as the victims and Israel as the criminals. We have to ensure that every Palestinian refugee is able to return to their home and that a Palestinian state is created with Jerusalem as its capital. And the second thing we have to do is we have to withdraw from these disastrous occupations of Muslim lands on which we are engaged, which are doing no good. Even the chief of the British Army General Staff told Mr. Blair in public, in what was effectively a mutiny, holding the flagship of his own government under the waterline, that the presence of British forces in Iraq was causing more harm than it could possibly do good, and that we must leave and leave soon. Nowadays, you cannot find any spokesman from the British government or increasingly from the American government who who will defend the cataclysmic, earth-shattering, disfiguring crime that they committed when they invaded Iraq on a pack of lies. Every single thing the anti-war movement said, and your anti-war movement was more successful than ours, you pulled Canada out of the war. Otherwise it would have been in the war if it was not for your anti-war movement led by the Stop the War Coalition. None of them now defend it. Now they're asking me how to solve it. How could you defend it? There were no weapons of mass destruction. There was no link to 9/11. There was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq, but there is now thousands and thousands of Al-Qaeda in Iraq now. There was no Islamist fundamentalist fanaticism in Iraq, but there is now. Iran, whom they armed Saddam Hussein and gave him money to fight Iran for 8 years, killing 1 million people because of their fear of the Islamic Revolution and Khomeini, has now been handed Iraq lock, stock and barrel by these foreign policy geniuses, Bush, Blair, Rumsfeld, Powell and the rest. Idiots, yes. They have not just broken Iraq into 100 pieces, shattered the hearts of the Iraqis, sent millions of them spinning overseas. Anyone with legs to carry them, with a skill to sell, is leaving the country, and there are millions. They have sent a pulse of hatred across the world, the reverberations of which will blight the lives of the youngest person in this room. A generation and more will have their lives affected, disfigured, overshadowed by the scale of this disastrous crime, this cataclysmic blunder. And Iraq, poor Iraq, Iraq, which 1,000 years ago, when my ancestors were still painting their faces blue and living in the forest, Iraq had the greatest library the world had ever seen. Iraq, with all its weight, all its importance to Islam, to the Arabs, to civilization, the country where the number zero was conceptualized, where algebra was invented, where the alphabet was first written down, where paper was first used as a medium of communication, where laws were first codified, where agriculture was first planted. Such an Iraq is now in the hands of the imbecile of Crawford, Texas, George W. Bush. What a fate! What a fate for such a nation! These occupations are deepening the swamp of hatred every day, watering it with new blood. Hundreds and hundreds of corpses floating up the Tigris, up the Euphrates, mounting in the morgues. Women, I heard some fool say on the television here in Canada that Iraq was invaded to liberate women. Iraqi women were the freest women in the whole of the Arab world, but now they can't stand outside their door for fear of being kidnapped and raped and murdered and taken hostage. Girls can't go to school or university. Such is the total collapse of Iraq, broken into 100 pieces. So we must withdraw from these occupations. I'm sometimes told by journalists, well, if we withdraw, there'll be chaos. To which I answer, you've obviously not got a television set. The only thing the Iraqis need from us is the sight of the back of our heads getting on aeroplanes and leaving their country and leaving it to them. And lastly, the third thing that we have to do is the most important of all. We have to stop propping up those corrupt kings and puppet presidents who rule the Muslim world almost without exception from one end to the other. The only democratically elected government in the entire Muslim world is the Palestinian government that Canada has starved because they voted for the wrong party. Kings and presidents rule their countries not for their own people, but so they can loot the wealth of their own countries for the benefit of others. You know, Muslims don't know whether to laugh or cry when they hear these leaders talking about fighting in Iraq for democracy, when in the country next door, Saudi Arabia, is the grimmest prison state on the earth, where there's no liberty or freedom or democracy of any kind, and never has been. Where women are not allowed to drive motor cars, not allowed to set foot on the street without a male relative, where they cut people's heads off in public, in the public squares, live on television, on Friday afternoons, for the intimidation of the others. We're fighting for democracy in Iraq whilst we're selling guns to the tyrants of Saudi Arabia to crush democracy and liberty in their own country. And there's another one I can give you, although I could give you many more, but one you probably don't know about. This day, the taxpayers of Great Britain are paying for the military training of the officer corps of the army of Colonel Gaddafi of Libya. That's the same Gaddafi that we said blew up an airliner over Lockerbie, killing hundreds of people. The same Gaddafi that we said funded the IRA's bombing campaign in England throughout the 1970s and 80s. The same Colonel Gaddafi that we said was a lunatic, a madman, a tyrant, a dictator. Does anybody think that Gaddafi changed? Or did he just change sides? Everybody knows that's why he's now a blue-eyed boy of Bush and Blair. Not because he's a different Gaddafi. He's still a son of a bitch. But he's now our son of a bitch. He's now our son of a bitch. Give me the keys. That's the direction that we need to go. They're not going to give me the keys. But we have to build a movement so big and so powerful and so united that we can force those who do have the keys to put on the brakes, to find the gear stick with the reverse gear, to stop watering the swamp with new blood, to start draining the swamp with policies of fairness and justice and equality. The slogan of the anti-war movement, which I like the best, which sums up not only our message best, but the quintessential truth in this story: no justice, no peace. If there's no justice, there will be no peace. Thank you very much.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. You're listening to The Brown Bagger and a speech by George Galloway on Monday the 20th, 2006 at the Trinity St. Paul's United Church, recorded by CKLN News, Ryerson Campus Community Radio.